Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to a brand new episode of the Film Stage Show, the official podcast of thefilmstage.com. As always, I'm your host, Brian J. Rowan. Part of my team today, Amanda Waltz. I was going to come up with something clever to say, and it just failed me.
Something spotlight slash tangerine related?
Yeah.
Oh.
But good luck.
That's not something you really want to say first thing in an episode, is it? So... she's back. It's been a while. How many miles has it been?
I wasn't on for the Spectre podcast.
You were not.
Man, you guys did not like that movie.
I didn't not like it less than other people did not like it. someone on Twitter, let me see if I can find it while I talk about it. But someone on Twitter said something along the lines of, "I've just seen the movie and boy, Brian, you liked that film way too much." And I just want to say to you, I didn't like it that much. It's Taylor
right.
Harford.
It's my distant relative,
like
Christoph.
I just didn't care as much as everyone else. Like, I didn't
to complain
I didn't,
about it, you mean?
Yeah. Like, people yeah. are like, "Oh, the romance is unbelievable." It's a Bond movie. Come on.
Like, romance?
I said it numerous times in that episode, and I'll say it again right now. Skyfall and Casino Royale have tricked us into believing that the Bond films were ever great when they were really just fun. Mm.
Oh, I did not like Casino Royale.
All right, then.
But
what?
I thought Skyfall was good. I enjoyed Skyfall thoroughly. Although I thought the villain in that was, like, so just not memorable, like, at
Casino
all.
Royale?
What? When he
not Casino
his...
Royale. Oh, Casino Royale. Mads Mikkelsen whipping him in the balls? No, that's super memorable. that's very memorable.
Hold on. So you're talking about Javier Bardem?
Oh, wait. Oh, no. Wait.
Yeah.
See, this is the problem because
he is
I
super memorable.
The thing is, I think
Bond
we just
films.
Proved it correct because, I mean, she super didn't remember that.
I think she's thinking of Quantum.
Well, wait, didn't he have... this is the problem. I have not seen any of the Bond films up until the Daniel Craig ones.
Right.
And the minute I walk out of them, I completely forget what happened.
This is why you weren't on the podcast.
Oh, yeah. It would have been bad. I would have been like, "Is this the one with the guy? And what happened?" Like, it's bad. Like, I confuse... Okay, so that was the one with Javier Bardem?
Yeah.
But wasn't there another guy that was like his partner, a white guy?
What?
Wait. Oh my god. This
False.
What are we talking about?
I don't know. I confuse the villains. I confuse the plots because there's like no plots. What?
Okay.
Right, but no, Javier Bardem was nothing you mentioned.
There are two other people to introduce still.
Sorry.
We
go ahead.
Have Dan Mecca.
Hey, what's up?
Not much. Do you know
I kept
who
wanting
Amanda's
to
phantom white guy is?
You know, I kept wanting to jump into that Bond conversation, but I was just kind of like, you know, I'm going to let this just keep going. I got nothing to really add to this.
Thanks for letting me dig myself deeper into this.
Like, I don't know what's going on here. I'm just going to enjoy myself. And here we are.
Probably bad.
Just along for the ride.
That's it.
No, but wasn't there a guy who flew? Didn't he fly a helicopter?
I don't know, man. What? I don't know. I honestly don't know what you're talking about.
Are you sure you didn't see Spectre?
I didn't see it.
Because there were helicopters and white guys all over Spectre.
But no, remember when they attacked? Remember when the Bond estate was getting attacked?
Yeah.
Wasn't there another guy besides Bardem who was attacking?
Yeah, there were a lot of guys.
I don't know.
Okay, Amanda's having a moment. Let's all say hi to Will Graham. Speaking of
hey guys.
Wait, so there were Komodo dragons in Skyfall, right?
Yes, there were Komodo dragons in Skyfall. That's why it was better than every other Bond movie.
Oh my god. So were the Komodo dragons the villain?
Yes, at the end of the movie, it turns out that they're attached to the lizard Illuminati.
So when they reveal, the big reveal is just there's Komodo dragons trying to take over the world, trying to get the microchip.
Even crazier is that the post-credit sequence lets you know that they win at some point.
Oh my god, I missed that. Brian, you spoiled it.
We're missing the mashup between Godzilla and Bond, obviously.
Oh my god.
Bondzilla?
Bondzilla.
But you guys did say that Christoph Waltz was a completely like ineffectual villain.
Well, you know, he had 5 minutes of screen time, so it's different.
Oh, really?
He had a white cat.
Did they set up another sequel?
I don't know. I don't know what's going on yet. It's making a shit ton of money, so probably.
Barf. Whatever.
Anyway. Oddly enough, you're not going to believe this, listeners at home, but we're not here to talk more about Bond this week. We're in fact here to talk about two films, neither of which I've seen, which is why I have this powerhouse of stunt casting beneath me. We're going to talk about Spotlight, the newest film by, I don't have
Tom
any
McCarthy.
Of my information up. It's Tom McCarthy, right?
That's all
right. Yeah.
Yep. Yep.
And this stars a literal who's who of Hollywood. It is Rachel McAdams, Mark Ruffalo.
Who's who that you can't remember, Brian.
No, there's Mark Ruffalo, Liev Schreiber, and I just can't remember Birdman's name, Michael Keaton.
Michael Keaton. So,
I know.
Pittsburgh native son.
Oh God!
Oh, wow!
God damn it!
whose real name is Michael Douglas, and he changed it because Michael Douglas was already famous.
Because Michael Douglas exists,
and he changed to Keaton out of respect for Buster Keaton. Fun fact. Yeah,
that's actually awesome.
Yeah, yeah.
This movie also stars Stanley Tucci.
And, Amanda, sorry to interrupt, Brian. Amanda, my fiance is from Pittsburgh, by the way.
No way, what neighborhood?
The South Hills, but the more specifically than that, but we can talk about it later, but South Hills area.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Oh.
Anyway, so yeah.
Brian, are you going to keep making jokes about Pittsburgh today?
Yeah, bro, two people. Yeah.
Is she still in Pittsburgh?
No, dude, she's in New York.
Right, yeah, she got out and got to a real city.
No, but Pittsburgh's the best. I love Pittsburgh.
Oh, yeah, damn, Mecca.
Love Pittsburgh. Jack Reacher, that car chase, unbelievable.
Oh, that's true.
And I've been to that bar, the bar that he gets in the fight at, Mario's. That's in downtown Pittsburgh. Great bar. A lot of Pittsburgh love, right? A lot of Pittsburgh bar having.
Yeah. I love you, Dan.
See? That's what I'm saying.
Well, my fiance's from Houston, so...
Ooh,
I really don't give a shit if you make fun of Houston.
Ooh, gotta have been to Houston. No, I'm kidding.
No, God, Houston's the worst. It's a fucking hot desert.
It's a traffic
swamp.
Nightmare.
Traffic like, nightmare.
Yeah.
Flat as hell. It's awful.
Oh, Texas.
What are we talking about?
Texas
are we talking about
anyway,
movies?
Stanley,
what are we
Stanley
talking about
Tucci.
Movies, right?
Stanley Tucci is also in the movie.
Yes, Stanley Tucci is
Tucci.
Not light.
Amanda.
I love Stanley
Tucci. Is everything okay?
Thank you so much. I can't even tell you.
Okay.
I love Stanley Tucci.
No one's like, it's not a problem, but you're just all over the place today.
Oh, I go, I'm the Tucci is loose, man.
The Tucci is indeed loose. Okay, we'll also be talking about Tangerine after we talk about Spotlight. That is new on VOD. It is a movie that was shot on an iPhone 5.
Was it a 5?
That is correct, iPhone 5.
Okay, so it's not even the 5S. It's just a 5. Impressive.
How'd they do it?
I don't know.
With such primitive technology.
I'm really curious. So if you get a phone call while you're recording something, does that just make it
on airplane mode?
Maybe.
These are the hard-hitting questions that we need to ask.
Okay.
Yes. So let's attempt to get this entire podcast back on track. Let's talk about Spotlight again, directed by Tom McCarthy. Guys, what was his last film?
Uh-oh.
Are we allowed to say?
A little known movie called The Cobbler.
Which I've
seen, and I'll say this quickly about The Cobbler, not to jump down a rabbit hole here, but I'll say this. It is not a good movie by any means. But the lengths at which it goes in its like ambitions as this like crazy, like I don't even know, comedy, like mystical comedy. It's so like the end of this movie, If you watch it on Netflix, at the end, you will just be like, what is happening?
You will lose your shit. Yeah. I actually skipped the entire movie and just watched the ending because I heard so much about it.
It's so strange. I was confounded. And like, that's all I'll say about it. That's just the cobbler. There it is.
Yeah.
Well, he also made Win-Win, The Visitor, and The Station Agent. So.
And he co-wrote Up.
Oh, did he?
Oh, did he really?
Yep.
So this is obviously like, a man of talent. So yeah,
from the beginning of that process, too. It wasn't like he was brought on later.
Mm.
So let's not hold the sins of the cobbler against him. Again, this movie features Rachel McAdams, Michael Keaton, Liev Schreiber, Mark Ruffalo, the Tooch.
Yeah.
And John Slattery of Mad Men. Here is the trailer.
I know there's things you cannot tell me. But I also know there's a story here, and I think everybody will hear about it.
Do you think your paper has the resources to take that on?
I do. Do you?
The Boston priests molested kids in 6 different parishes over the last 30 years. The church found out about it and did nothing. We haven't committed any long-term investigative resources to the case.
No, we haven't.
And that's the kind of thing your team would do.
Spotlight? Guys, listen. Everybody's going to be interested in this.
Obviously, the church will fight us very hard.
I'm trying to get some background.
So that's Spotlight. It is the story of the Spotlight investigative journalism team for the Boston Globe and how they uncovered the Catholic priest molestation scandal. I guess scandal.
Cover up.
Way to put it, but it's the massive.
I guess scandal.
I mean, I would say travesty, but
yeah.
The cover-up that systematically allowed priests within the church to transfer around and continue to commit these heinous crimes. So, let's talk about it. Amanda.
I haven't seen it.
You did not see Spotlight.
I was one of the people that did not see it.
Yes. So, Amanda will be sitting out. But, again, we have a massive brain trust of talent. Dan Mecca.
What up?
And Will Graham. You two will be talking about Spotlight.
Yes, indeed.
Sweet. Dan.
I do love in the trailer, and it happens in the movie, when Liev Schreiber goes to Michael Keaton, like, that'd be something your team would do. And like we all, in that scene, everybody in that room knows that Michael Keaton's team is Spotlight. And I just like, in the movie and in the trailer, like Michael Keaton says, like, oh, Spotlight? It's like, yeah, dude, we know. But part of the paper you run, this, you know, that's probably the biggest criticism I'll throw at this movie, which is probably
I'm glad you addressed that, because the trailer, well, it's just saw funny that and I'm because, like, really?
And when you see the movie, his character, I will say, to kind of almost walk back the criticism, his character is that type of guy. So he's like a kind of like a hyped up guy who like would be the type of guy who would like say obvious things in a conversational type of thing. But anyway, this is probably my favorite movie of the year so far.
Wow.
I loved it dearly, and I think, you know, all, you know, it's been getting a lot of critical love, and I don't know how much I can honestly add to any kind of any review you'll read. I mean, this is in line with kind of great criminal law movies, conspiracy movies, journalistic movies like The Verdict and
The Devil's
Advocate. all the President's Men, and you know, to a lesser degree, State of Play, which came out a few years ago.
My cousin Vinny,
The Rainmaker. No, but you know what I mean. It is like, this is a movie I think that will, you know, ultimately years from now be regarded as one of our great films. And I think one of the reasons it is. It will probably be one of those movies is because there's no additives in the story. I mean, it's basically like a lot, like if you watch All the President's Men and The Verdict, there's not a lot of dramatic assistance. Like there's not a lot of score. There's not a lot of dramatic, like monologue moments. Mark Ruffalo has one. Michael Keaton has like a little bit, but really they tell the story, and Tom McCarthy relies so, like, it has so much trust in his actors and so much faith in like the words that were written. I think he co-wrote with I think it's Eric Singer, I believe. And And
Josh Singer,
sorry. And really, there's not much. I mean, it starts from the beginning where Liev Schreiber plays the new non-Boston, not Catholic, I believe he's Jewish, editor-in-chief of the Boston Globe. And he like comes in and everybody's kind of like, who's this guy? And then he, because he has this kind of outsider mindset, he, you know, like you see in the trailer, he kind of brings up this thing of like, hey, so what's up with these priests that are molesting kids? And why does nobody write about that? And then it really becomes this just rabbit hole of why has nobody been talking about this for 35 years? And it kind of reminds you of when that story came out and how, you know, it's that judgment in Nuremberg thing of like, everybody knew something bad was going on, but nobody felt that it was their responsibility to do anything about it. And the Boston Globe is just as responsible as anybody else. And the movie does take tasks about how the fact that like the Globe had all the info to write that story 15 years earlier and never did anything about it. So it's like an interesting movie because in All the President's Men, for example, it does present basically Woodward and Bernstein as heroes. And they were heroes in a way, but in this movie, it is a little interesting because there's that added layer of like, hey, this was happening and, you know, kids' lives were being destroyed for like decades and you guys knew and you know what I mean? So there's an interesting kind of quandary there. And yeah, I mean, Mark Ruffalo gives kind of a very mannered performance that I feel like is going to get maybe the most attention just because it's so specific and he's doing a lot of things. But for me, the all-stars are Michael Keaton and Billy Crudup, who we didn't even mention, is unbelievable. He's got this small role and you think he's going to be like kind of the shitty James Mason from The Verdict character, like a shifty lawyer. And it's not that character at all. It goes into another direction. And yeah, it's just a really interesting movie that somehow manages to kind of surprise you, even though you think you know everything about the story. So, yeah, I have nothing but good things to say about it, really.
All right. Well, let's see if William Graham agrees with you.
I absolutely agree with you. it's a film that definitely has an all-star cast that don't have a lot of flashy roles or things like that. I think Mark Ruffalo definitely steals a lot of scenes. He's just kind of endlessly watchable in just about anything. But he's got a very hunched shoulder kind of goofy charm to him in this film. He seems like a very interesting person. And the film basically, you know, it is a procedural almost. It goes step by step by step into the investigation that the Spotlight team goes through. And so like it doesn't skip ahead in time. It doesn't do any of that stuff. There's not a lot of back and forth. It's pretty much you're with the team, you know, the whole film, and their main priority the entire time is to, you know, focus on the story itself. And so, you know, you learn little things. You learn little certain things are continually repeated. Some of the abuse victims mention certain things about, you know, the way they were kind of seduced and things like that. And then even they find, you know, the priests themselves, how they track it down is really interesting as well. And it's a film that, like I said, it doesn't have a lot of flashy roles. There's one dramatic moment with Brian D'Arcy, who has just this really wicked kind of moment where he figures out something is on his street. And that's really, I mean, the flashiest moment of the entire film. Everything else is very, very subtle. It's not shot in any particularly, you know, stylistic way. It's a very, very straightforward movie. And based on that, I think it's going to get a lot of praise, but I think it's going to go, I don't know. It's a weird film because it's just so incredibly competently made, but it doesn't have a lot of that flash that will garner a lot of attention beyond that. Which is, you know, it's a good thing. It's a story about a newspaper, you know, investigation, and it doesn't need to be much more than that. But I did like Dan's point about the fact that it does kind of get at some of the newspaper. You know, it's not completely pro Spotlight. It does mention some things about, you know, the corruptibility of humans and, you know, the press in general. The fact that, you know, 15 years earlier, they did have the information, and some of the people they're dealing with know this absolutely, and they feel kind of burned by the press. And so, you know, they're very reluctant to cooperate at that point. You know, either the church has kind of, you know, come down hard on them, or, you know, something else has happened and they've just kind of lost faith in the fact that the press is going to do anything about this. So,
yeah. And one thing I like, you know, is that the Catholic Church actually doesn't play a huge role in the film. And I almost appreciated that, because the institution has become such a well-known villain. It's almost like cigarettes. You know what I mean? You're almost just like, oh yeah, I consider myself a Catholic as we speak. Right. But the institution I reel against so much, you know what I mean? Yeah. That like, it seems so villainous, I think, in the eyes of everyday Americans, and that's separating the institution from the, you know, kind of what's, you know, what's taught or what's, you know, kind of whatever believed. But so I do like that in the movie, it's way more about the process, and there's not, you don't really have like an evil like archbishop coming in and being like, you should really stop writing that story. You know what I mean? Because it's like,
I was actually going to ask about that.
You don't need it. It's like, you know, the church, like that would be an active, thing that the church is doing. And the point that the movie's basically trying to make is that like, it was the fact that these people were not taking any action. They were like moving these priests around so that they could just rape other kids in other like parts of Boston or other parts of the United States or, you know, the world. And that's the people also forget, this is an international thing. Like, it's not like it just happened in the United States. This is like, it happened everywhere, you know, and it like still, it's still happening. So I just kind of, you know, I like that the movie focused on the facts and didn't kind of create some sort of like nebulous bad priest or something. You know what I mean? It, you know, really focuses on, you know, the people in the Boston Globe.
Yeah, because the nightmare version of this movie would involve like a Cardinal Richelieu-esque
exactly figure,
like coming to the Globe and being like, "You think you can stop us?" We're the goddamn movie, Catholic Church, and I don't care if that's reflexively.
The closest the movie thing. Gets is there's, and it's funny. It's like played more for a joke or like just a cynical joke. Is Liev Schreiber goes to meet, I guess, the head of whatever, the Boston Diocese, I believe, and and the guy, the head, whatever he is, bishop, whatever the fuck he is, gives him a gift, right? And he knows he's Jewish, and then he like makes mention of it, whatever. And then Liev Schreiber gets in his car and he opens up the gift, and it's like a book. It's like a Catholic catechism book, you know, like to learn Catholicism.
Oh my
and you're
God.
Just like, ugh, Catholics are the worst.
Oh my God.
Yeah,
it's funny. Because when my husband and I were getting married, he has a friend who we saw at a wedding, and he had just gotten married, and he's super Catholic. And the entire time he was like, "Are you guys thinking about getting married in the Catholic Church?" And trying so hard to convince us to get married in the Catholic Church. And I lied.
Are either of you Catholic?
Quaker.
What?
Ian was raised Catholic. I don't think he's would really consider himself a Catholic. I was raised, I'm Pennsylvania Dutch, so it's like, it doesn't matter. it's like Lutheran Methodist. It's weird. I don't know. But I told him I was a Quaker. I was just like, dude, I don't want to talk about this with you.
Yeah, because I just recently became engaged and my fiance is not Christian and I am Catholic. So everyone's like, oh my God, what's going to happen? What are you going to do? And I was like, we talked about it. We're getting married in a Catholic church. It's fine.
It's really weird how weird people get about it. But yeah, it's just funny because, like, well, I thought we were gonna anyway. I'm not gonna go into this. But yeah.
Well, that's one of the reasons I wanted to see Spotlight. Of the two movies that I was unable to see this weekend, I'm most upset about Spotlight because, as a Catholic, this is something that really, you know, on a political and social level, this was awful, and on a religious level, it was also incredibly difficult to deal with. So I wanted to see the movie. Also, I'm a journalism major, so this movie's like made for me.
And yeah, it definitely gets into the nitty gritty of the journalist side. And one thing that's really interesting I found about the film is that it leans very heavily on the fact that the Boston Globe, I believe at the time, and you know, still is owned by the New York Times, and so.
Oh, really?
They lean on the fact that they are, you know, obviously in Boston, they are the head dog, right? And they have another reporting branch for another smaller, you know, local newspaper. And at one point they mentioned to the reporter in the room, they're like, hey, you need to leave. And he's like, we're covering this story too. And they're like, no, you're not. Like,
oh, wow.
We are the big dog. We have the power. We have the money. We have the readership to basically do the investigative journalism that needs to be done in this particular case. And it's a sad reflection of newspapers, you know, in this day and age, because the small town newspapers are not going to have the ability to do these kind of investigative journalism stories because they don't have the resources, but they also don't have the time to pull their reporters off and go follow a story for 6, 7, 8 months to turn into a story, you know, a year later.
Right.
That's crazy. That's not going to happen for some of these smaller newspapers. And so it's up to the big dogs to kind of, you know, lead that charge. And it kind of sucks. It's a sad reflection of our time that, you know, investigative journalism, long form journalism is one of the first things that gets cut as far as like a budget is concerned.
Well, what year did this happen?
2001.
Oh, was it really that long ago?
Yep.
And there's an interesting Bill. I don't know if you were just going to say this, but it does. Yep. It's an interesting thing in this movie how it handles 9/11, right? Because 9/11 happens in this movie and in real life, obviously when they were doing the story, and it's an interesting way they handle it because they're in the middle of this like you know, barn burning, groundbreaking story, kind of scandalous thing, and this unbelievable tragedy happens and they have to like stop everything they're doing because of this. And it's an interesting take on that terrible day because obviously everybody wants to mourn, but they're also like, but we can't just stop, you know, stop what we're doing, you know, in this other world. And so it's an interesting kind of, I don't know. I mean, I don't know that I've seen a movie handle that, and it's handled pretty deftly. Like, it doesn't feel, I don't know, you know, it doesn't feel like poorly handled or anything. It was just interesting to watch.
Mm-hmm. One thing that's really interesting about that moment is the film introduces you to 2001. Lee Schreiber is coming in as the new editor of the Globe, and he comes in at 2001, and you know, they flash 2001 up on the screen. And it just never registered with me. And until that moment happens, when they revealed the 9/11 attacks, I was completely drawn into the film to the point where I just had no clue. And then, you know, they show it on the screen and you're like, oh crap, this is 2001. You know what? And that says something. That says a lot about the film itself, how much it kind of draws you in to the point where you just are not expecting that moment to happen, because of course it's going to happen. It's 2001, right? And so it's a really interesting kind of moment. The other thing I wanted to kind of mention was the fact that this is, you know, more along the lines of the journalism side of it. This story itself is one of the few moments I can recall seeing a journalism, you know, film, things like that, really hit on the fact that there are a couple of different styles or types of stories that you can do as far as like investigative journalism. You can, you know, shine literally a spotlight on certain scandals. Yeah. you can just kind of, you know, reveal things that are going to happen or that have happened, or you can really try and make institutional change. You can try and follow that rabbit hole as far as you can, you know, as you can go, and see if you can get it from the top down. And that's really kind of the crux of this film, is Liev Schreiber and a couple of the other editors have to make that tough choice of, do we rush to publish this information that could help people right now, or do we try and make institutional change that could last? And that's the real big kind of crux of this film that I think, you know, it gets to journalism in general, you know, where it's so easy to rush to publish. It's a lot more difficult to hold back on a story and try and actually make change.
Well, and it's interesting that you say that too, because I haven't seen the film, so I'm really interested to see how it handles it, because like I really want to see I mean, journalism is such a tedious, I think just especially investigative reporting, it's a very tedious process. It's a lot of phone calls. It's a lot of, you know,
a lot of follow-up interviews.
Yep. Like, it's incredibly painstaking. And so to make something like that exciting or palatable to a movie audience is, you know, it's interesting to see how he, I'm really interested to see how he approaches that. And also just to, you know, it's like hard to keep something like that authentic, because it's not exciting. It's almost kind of like, I always think of the movie Zodiac, because I think Zodiac is one of the few films that really showed how, like, you know, investigating a crime is not super glamorous, guys. It takes an insanely long time. There's a lot of dead ends, you know, and it's just one of those things where, yeah, I think that's the thing that's like really drawing me to this film at this point.
Yeah.
Well, right, I gotta say, it pulls it off really well. So,
okay, cool, awesome. I'm excited to see it.
As am I. And that is the end of our spotlight review. That makes it sound like we have a spotlight review. That is the end of our review of the film Spotlight.
Oh, you talking about spot? You talking about Spotlight?
Talking about Spotlight.
Spotlight. Wait, what?
Welcome to Spotlight Talk.
My team.
Okay.
Oh, my team. Spotlight. My team.
Spotlight. Is that going to become a thing now?
Just in the middle of a conversation, someone's like, "Damn, what are you thinking? Oh, you talking about Spotlight?
Spotlight."
I love Michael Keaton. Michael Keaton he's like an enigma of an actor. He's such a strange talent.
I'm so happy he's back. Like
he's
got another movie coming out next year where he plays the guy who like corporatized McDonald's, Ray Kroc. It's called The Founder.
That's gonna be awesome.
Jesus.
And so I guess my point is, I just love how, you know, he's back. Like, he's just like doing, you know, he's getting the roles that he like didn't get during Jack Frost Dark Ages. You know what I mean? He's back. I love it.
He was great in The Other Guys.
Yeah, but beginning. That was like 2010, you know, when people were like, "Hey, Michael Keaton's still doing it. Pittsburgh's first son. Still
man. Started on Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood."
Okay. It was a mistake having two people with ties to Pittsburgh on the same podcast. Especially
no,
talking
just
about
Amanda.
Michael Keaton.
Just you're Amanda.
You talk about Spotlight.
Spotlight?
Yeah. Spotlight?
Okay. Everybody calm down. Now we're going to talk about Tangerine. And this is a film by Sean Baker, written and directed, co-written, I should say, along with Chris Burgich. Anyone
Burgess?
Want to fight me on how to spell that or pronounce that? Great.
Mm.
And this is a movie about a prostitute who is searching for her pimp/boyfriend after he has cheated on her. And like we said, this is all shot on location on an iPhone 5. And here's the trailer.
Cinderella. Looks like someone has a crush.
Cindy's back on the block?
Oh, yeah, she's back. She's back and she's going hard.
Merry Christmas, bitch.
Woo!
I got some good news to tell you about me and Chester.
I know what it is.
You're breaking up with him. Thank God.
I'm gonna be cheating on you like that.
Wait. What?
You didn't know?
White boy. Who is she?
Her name starts with a D.
Danny.
Desiree.
Destiny?
You're making me lose my game.
She's some white fish.
Chester, is she know me with real fish?
Yeah, bitch, like a real fish. Girl, like vagina and everything.
Girl, calm the fuck down. It's not that serious.
So this is Tangerine. let's talk about it. Will Graham, you did not see Tangerine.
I did not, but I'm very curious to hear all about it.
Well, you started watching it.
Yeah, I was about to say. Unlike me and Amanda, who just straight up didn't get around to watching certain things, you made an active choice.
Yes. I didn't walk out of the theater.
You got a screener.
Yeah. I just stopped watching it. I'm just like, not right now.
Not for me. Okay. I am also looking forward to watching this. That's all I can really say. Amanda Waltz. Haven't heard from you in an official capacity yet outside of your thoughts on James Bond. So why don't you kick us off with your thoughts on Tangerine?
So I can understand why you were not totally in on this film when you started watching it. I think you said you turned it off like 10 minutes in.
Oh, much sooner than that. Probably okay. 2 minutes in. I heard a bunch of foul language, and I saw them talking in a
foul
diner.
Foul language?
And I was like,
your monocle
like,
popped out of your eye into your martini glass. You clutched your... You're like, oh no! Foul language.
I was just like, I really hope it doesn't take place only in this diner with them two talking.
No, it doesn't.
Okay, good.
But I can understand this film takes some time to settle into because I actually, when it started, and I mean, it looks like a music video, and it is...
Music videos are gorgeous, though, so...
Well, it's a certain style, like modern style of music video. Okay. But I mean, it's... Yeah, when it started, I was like, ooh, this is going to be rough. But then it really finds its stride, I would say, like about 15, 20 minutes. Because I felt like that was how I was with Inherent Vice. Like, when I started watching the movie Inherent Vice, I was like, oh, man, I'm going to walk out of this film. And that was a movie I saw in the theater. And then after about 15, 20 minutes, I was like, oh, this is actually okay. It was just kind of the same reaction to this where I had such a nervous reaction to it. And then I immediately loved it. Like, it went from I hate this movie to I love this movie. I actually thought it was a pretty amazing comedy with a lot of heart, surprisingly. It's kind of a weird love letter to Los Angeles. Which I believe is where it takes place. Because it's...
Yeah, it takes place in Los Angeles.
Yeah, it takes place in Los Angeles. Although it's... You know, it's a very, like, diverse film. There's an Armenian cab driver. You have scenes with his family. Then, of course, you have the two leads, Cindy and Alexandra, who are both trans. They're both, I believe the woman is Kiki Katana Rodriguez, who plays Cindy. She's very, I don't know, there's just something, they just have this like very like unfiltered quality about them that I really appreciate. And I never felt at all like, and I think I can see maybe like how some people would go into this movie thinking like, oh, this is just going to like make fun of these like very outrageous trans characters. It's never like jokes made at their expense. It's more like, oh, these are just very funny characters. These are two characters who are very funny, who are sort of making fun of this crazy world around them. It's a very young movie. There are a lot of references made that I don't think a lot of people like. There's a scene where a guy skateboards by and she says, oh, he think he little Wayne. There's just like a whole bunch of different that I think like references that people maybe like an older audience wouldn't understand. I I enjoyed this movie.
That's smart, right? I mean, because it's the language of their time. Yeah. It's like, how would they talk to amongst themselves? They would talk in that way. They wouldn't be like, oh, I wonder if my grandma will understand this reference. Like, no. They don't care.
And I wondered how much of this is scripted. I was actually very surprised to learn that the Duplass brothers produced it.
Yeah.
Of course.
Why are you surprised to learn that?
Yeah. I don't know. I would never connect this movie with the Duplass brothers.
It takes place in LA. It was
okay.
Shot on a low grade camera.
And
it seems heavily improvised.
Well, no,
what,
so
what
actually,
part of this doesn't scream Duplass brothers?
Everything else.
Yeah, I mean, it's way different. I mean, it's not like it's the energy in this movie. It's so much different than any Duplass Brothers movie. You know what I mean?
They just produced it.
Well, right. Yeah. But I got a chance to interview. I saw this at Sundance, actually, in January. And I got a chance to interview Sean Baker about who directed the movie, about kind of everything. And I think it's more scripted than you would think. I mean, I think the general gist of like what was going to happen was in there. And then I think like in terms of improvisation, towards the end, the pimp who James Ransone plays, who they're like trying to find, he has a lot of like conspiracy theory stuff that he's high and he's like talking about. I think a lot of that was improvised. And maybe some of the like insults kind of peppered throughout. But I think a lot of it was scripted. I got a chance to speak with Mia Taylor as well, who plays, I believe she plays Alexandra, and she's so great in the movie. And she was saying how they relied on Sean Baker a lot for like a lot of the lines, but also a lot of the conversation they have, because these are two trans women who are playing, like you said, prostitutes who are kind of running around downtown Los Angeles. A lot of it was taken from kind of everyday experiences as well. So I don't know. This movie for me was definitely the best thing I saw at Sundance, and still one of the best things I've seen this year. So it's been a good podcast of these two movies, or like highlights of the year for me. But I don't know, the energy in this movie, and I kind of get what you're saying with the beginning of the movie. Oh, I remember when I saw it in theaters for the first 20 minutes, I was kind of like, I don't know if I love this movie or if I hate it, because it was so much, and there's so much talking, and there's so much like, culture shock's not the right word, but it drops you into a specific scenario in a specific time in a specific place. And for a while, I think I had trouble, honestly, like, just getting into it. And then, but then by the end, I cared so much about these two women and their friendship and kind of what they'd been through that, I don't know. I felt like it was really effective. And it's weird, 'cause I feel like every year when you go to a festival like Sundance, there's always a movie like this where it's like Tangerine was shot all on an iPhone. And then I feel like a lot of the time, that movie you see and you're like, yeah, but it's garbage.
Oh, this is a great time to bring up Escape from Tomorrow. This is a great time to bring up Escape from Tomorrow.
That is the perfect example, because I saw that movie with Rafiez Dorian and Jordan Raup, I believe, both film stagers, obviously, at Sundance. And I saw it at the screening, and everybody was like, oh, this is the movie he shot in Disney World in secret. And then you see the movie and you're like, all right. Okay, you know what I mean? And you kind of come away from it a little underwhelmed. And this movie is not that. This movie, they use the aesthetic of putting an iPhone on like a mini crane and putting an iPhone on like a makeshift kind of, Steadicam scenario. Like, they make it all work. And like the shakiness when it comes feels apropos to this thing of like this 2015 – this is how you'd almost record a viral video of like, oh, this person's going after this girl because she cheated with his man, like type of thing, right? But then it goes to a deeper place, right? And it's like, these people have problems, just like the Armenian cab driver has problems, just like we have problems, and they're different problems, but in a way, and not at all. And like, and that sounds way too "We Are the World" for this movie, but I mean, that is like the best part about that movie is it achieves that without getting like Amistad on you. You know what I mean? Without getting like someone explaining it in a 6-minute, you know, a trial setting. You know what I mean? Like, it's like it achieves all that within the confines of like a well-told story, you know, in which feels very real, you know.
Well, it's not trying to I think a lesser film would try to sensationalize that, oh, they're prostitutes and they're trying to survive on the streets and this is their everyday existence.
Transgender prostitutes, no less.
Oh yeah, which it does not really hit on that and how...
Well, yeah, best part of this movie is that it's a story about, you know, two transgender people.
Right.
But it's not like a Boys Don't Cry. I mean, that's a great movie in another way. But we need to get to a place in our filmmaking where you can just tell these stories. Like, you know, you can tell a story about a homosexual and he's not the gay best friend. You know, he's
exactly.
Not,
and
he's
I
not
think that's
Rupert Everett from My Best Friend's Wedding. It can be about a guy who's like that. And I love that movie and I love Rupert Everett in it. But you can also tell the story about where it's like he's a homosexual or, you know, she's a homosexual and it's not, you know, and the kids are all right. It's kind of like that. You know what I mean? Where you can get past this thing of like, hey, come on. Like, this
I
still have a lot of feelings about the kids are all right. Cause that movie is like, let's be honest, that relationship was awful.
Yeah. That movie can be a little preachy at times where the kids are like, oh, you just want us to be like, the good kids with the
perfect
lesbian family.
In that movie, the kids are all right.
Yeah, the kids are
fine. It's true.
I just every time I see that movie, I just feel bad for Mark Ruffalo from Spotlight.
You're talking about Spotlight?
Because at the end of that movie, like, he was this guy, he had a life, and then these people like rushed into his life and made him a part of it, and then at the end they just like kicked him out. And I'm like, man, why you gotta treat Mark Ruffalo like such shit?
He's such a doll, baby. I actually saw him in real life. He was filming Foxcatcher in Pittsburgh, and I saw him at a pizza parlor. And he is like the size of my thumb. He's very small.
Your thumb must be gigantic.
You see him in the Avengers, and you're like, oh wow, Mark Ruffalo, he's kind of like a, you know, he looks like he's got some, you know, some heft on him, but like, no, he's super tiny.
That's like Hillary Clinton is like 2 feet tall.
Oh,
I ran into her
camera.
Once.
Okay.
I was an intern on Capitol Hill, and I ran into someone, and when I turned around to say excuse me, it was Hillary Clinton, and she looked up at me with her eyes, and I was terrified.
Do you know who I am?
It was legitimately like she just like took a snapshot of my face in her brain. So she's like, "When I become president, you're gonna die."
I wouldn't screw with hell.
No, I'd never been more afraid of a single person.
So this film, what it sounds like is basically. How long does it stay in the diner and kind of lay out
it's
the,
in the diner
the
for like a second and then they're out.
No, I mean it's they're in the diner for a few minutes because they set up the whole that conversation that we heard in the trailer bit,
right.
You know, where I believe it's I can't remember if it's Alexandra's the one who is cheated on or is it Cindy's cheated on?
Cindy was cheated on.
Okay,
yeah,
so and then it's Alexandra's like, does you know? She's like, oh, good, you're gonna break up with Chester because blah blah blah, he's cheating on you. And then literally, basically for an hour, you're like following them around this like, I don't know, 10-block radius in Los Angeles where she's looking for this woman Desiree or whatever her name is who like cheated on Chester. You know, they've been having, I guess, like an affair or whatever. And then it does end up going back to the diner.
Right.
But it's just, I don't know. It's like a real exciting movie. And once I was invested in it, I kind of couldn't take my eyes off of like just what was going on. And just like, and also it's like so beautifully shot, you know, like the orange, the burnt in orange kind of like the movie's called Tangerine. And I feel like it is representative of actually like the aesthetic of the movie. I think that's kind of part of the point. It like feels like that. It looks like that. So, I don't know. Well,
you were saying there was like crane shots earlier.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I think you expect it just to be so low tech and so no frills, and then all of a sudden there's this overhead crane shot, and you're like, wait, what? How did they do this? Were they gonna roof? It
and,
looks
right,
great.
And what Sean Baker basically was saying is that they basically shot it with no permits. Except they would get it. They would get permits when they needed to. But this is a really, you know, obviously a low budget movie. And he just said it's like the beauty of shooting it on the iPhone is that you can get those moves by doing even smaller moves on that iPhone feel bigger because obviously you're doing so much more. And if you put those kind of those like lenses, you can put those. You can buy those like small lenses that you can literally put on the edge. Of your camera, and you can just do fisheye, and it's like explodes the frame. You know what I mean? So there's a lot of cool stuff that they are able to do for way less money because of the iPhone, and it doesn't detract. It adds to it. I mean, it's its own type of movie. You know what I mean? Not a lot of movies. Yeah. It's like it feels a lot like Crank. You know, the Crank movies kind of have a similar feel in the way that.
Yes.
You know? And I mean, those movies are great in their own way, and this movie is kind of the next step. You know, it's like
other filmmakers, because I know that Danny Boyle has used. Phone before to film. So I mean, this isn't necessarily a new concept, but I think this is just taking it to the next level. And it's also, you know, it's just, it's like you were saying, Dan, this is just a movie about a friendship, about these two friends. And it's actually a very well-written story where, you know, you have parallel storylines, you have I'm not going to ruin it, of course, but you have like a twist ending. You have these sort of complex characters.
The tangerine was inside of them all along.
Oh my God, it was. Brian.
The real tangerine was.
The twist is that it's all about Spotlight.
Oh,
Spotlight?
Watching.
Also, I just need to say, I know I said earlier this is kind of a weird love letter to LA. It's also kind of an odd love letter to Hollywood and how like it's changed, because there's a scene where we're following these two women, we're also following this cab driver. It's a man named cab driver Ramzik, I think is his name.
Razmik. It says on IMDb.
Okay, it's Razmik. And it's just sort of following him as he's at first it's him with his various passengers. There's one in particular, and he's an old man, and he's talking about being a Cherokee, and his name is Clu Gulager, the actor, and he is a very prolific actor. He's been in tons of TV westerns, tons of movies, horror icon. He was in Return of the Living Dead.
Started TV westerns.
Damn it! he was in a ton of TV westerns. He was in a ton of movies. He was in like B movies, horror movies. He was in Return of the Living Dead. He was in the Piranha movies, the Piranha 3D. Piranha 3D. But he's 86 years old. I mean, he's known Hollywood since the beginning. I mean, he's been there, and to see him in this sort of new movie, this new young movie, it's almost sort of like wow, this guy is like, I don't know, it's just so interesting to see something like that. And he's great in the movie. He's really funny. He's telling the story about how when he was born, his name is Mia, and he's like, you know, you think that's a woman's name, but in Cherokee it means red bird. And he's amazing, and I'm like, this man is 86 years old and he is killing it in this movie. But it's just so cool to see this like actor who's been there forever in this like new movie. And it's like I said before, it's such a young movie. It actually reminded me a lot of, you know, when I used to watch IFC as a kid, when IFC actually showed independent films.
Put a bird on it.
What's that?
I said put a bird on it.
Put a bird on it. And I would watch, you know, like the indie new wave of the 90s. It really reminded me a lot of that. It reminded me of like Linkletter's Slacker, just how sort of everything is sort of like a little segment of its own, where you see, you know, you see them go to like the laundromat, and then you see them go to this burrito restaurant, and then you see them go, and there's like each one is kind of its own little episode. And, you know, I really like that. And I really like how sort of like low tech, and it's, there's just something very exciting and like new about it.
Is this similar to Linklater's, you know, Before Sunset trilogy in the way that it takes place in real time?
Yeah. I don't know if I don't know if I would necessarily
compare. I mean,
let's
yeah.
we could
yeah,
we could I mean, just no. say, does this appear to take place in real time?
Yes and no. I mean, it takes place definitely in a night. I mean, it cuts
like
around
over the course
a bit
of a day. Yeah, because
yeah.
I think
it's not like it's more like before. Yeah, it's more like Before Midnight, where that's not real time, but almost real.
Well,
time. You know what I mean?
Before
where,
sunrise,
before sunset not, is. Yeah, Before Sunset is literally 80 minutes without it's like 80 minutes in their life. But
yes.
the first and the third one, I think, are a little bit more over the course of a night. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, and Tangerine is more like that. But also, it's a weird apples and oranges thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
it's
very
different.
Weird. I did think that Chester's character reminded me a lot of
apples and tangerine.
Chester's character actually reminded me a lot of a. What's his from Trailer Park Boys? What's his name? The one guy.
Bubbles?
Do you guys watch Trailer Park Boys? Not Bubbles. the aspiring rapper guy. The cartoonishly. Does anybody watch this show, guys?
No, I hate that show.
No.
You hate Trailer Park Boys?
Yeah.
What?
Well,
sue me. I don't give a shit.
Was it filmed in Pittsburgh? Is that why you like it so much, man?
Well, I mean, it does talk about a trailer park, and that's pretty much the entire city of Pittsburgh, right? So maybe it's just a fellowship thing? I don't know.
Okay.
No, it just... His character is... What I'm trying to get at is his character is a little cartoonish. But other than that, I really like this movie. And I also like how it captured how boring hooking is. Just how... How dull that life is, and how just like, you know, just like standing around on the street all day, it's like, this is very boring. Or appears to be very boring. I wouldn't know, but I think it really captured just like,
yeah, it sounded like not to be mean, but for a brief second it sounded as though you were like, finally someone understands how boring hooking is.
Well, you know what I mean, but it like captures how mundane it really, like, because this obviously this is their life, like this is what they know, so it's, but it's like that if this is what you do every day, it's gonna get like mundane and boring just standing around. And as a, like I said before, it's like not sensationalizing it and making it seem like, oh, this is such a tragedy, it's so horrible that these people have to live like this. It's more just like, oh, you know, like, this is boring as hell. Like, you're just standing around, like, waiting. Like, I don't know.
Oh, goodness. All right. Well, that's it for today.
Thanks for ending it on that note, Brian.
You're welcome. the structural integrity of this Skype phone call, which has been tenuous to begin with, only appears to be breaking down further.
Yes.
So, I'm calling it. This is the end. Obviously, we all really... Well, we... The people who saw these films really enjoyed them. So I'm looking forward to getting some time this week to check them out. I will perhaps speak my thoughts on the next show. As for what the next show is going to be about, I don't know. Does anyone know what the next show is going to be about?
Well, I know that, Jordan gave us some ideas.
Yeah, I was going to say The Hunger Games, Mockingjay Part 2.
Yep.
The Night Before, which I actually think looks kind of funny, but, you know, comedies are difficult to talk about on a podcast, mm-hmm. So we probably won't talk about that.
I don't know if we can do a better Christmas comedy than Tangerine.
What was that?
I don't know if you can find a better Christmas comedy than Tangerine.
This is true. I am probably going to find some time to go out and see Brooklyn with Saoirse Ronan. I don't know why, but I just really want to see that movie. So I'm going to do that. So maybe we'll talk about that. Who knows? Tune in next time to find out. In the meantime, here's where you can find us online. Will Graham.
At Twitter. So it's going to be at CableBFG. And then, of course, reviewing and interviewing on the film stage.
All right. Dan Mecca.
Twitter, DJ Mecca.
DJ
and
Mecca.
And always the film stage.
It's so sad that you're not a DJ.
No. No, no.
You talking about Spotlight?
Spotlight. You talking Spotlight? Spotlight.
Damn it.
I haven't even seen this movie, and now I'm laughing at this reference.
Well, you've heard the trailer.
Not really, actually.
She tuned that out.
Oh, Spotlight? Anyway, Amanda Waltz, where can we find you? Pittsburgh, I know.
Oh, go to hell, Brian.
I've been playing Fallout 4, you know, a little bit, and so I feel like I've been to Pittsburgh.
Oh,
I hate you.
Slam on Pittsburgh.
Wow, so creative, Brian. Yeah, Pittsburgh is a post-apocalyptic wasteland. Wow. Yeah, you never did that one before.
No, I've never gone to that particular well.
Fresh.
Anyway. I'm just going to look up a bunch of actual facts about Pittsburgh.
You will be surprised. We put French fries on everything. You really going to
know
get
that? Yeah. You got what? Permanente Brothers? Is that it?
Permanente Brothers?
Yeah.
I'm not going to shill for Permanente Brothers. okay. So I'm on Twitter at Media Waltz. I am also Media Waltz on Letterboxd. I periodically write for the film stage. And you can also find my blog, Steel Cinema, on WordPress.
All right. And you can find me on Twitter, at Brian J. Rowan. You can also find me on Letterboxd, at Brian J. Rowan. And writing for the film stage, and my personal site, dearfilm.net. So, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us. Tune in next time.